Welcome to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn here on Radio Free Brooklyn, where we interview women who are kicking buns both big and small throughout the borough. Every episode features an in-depth talk with a female mover and shaker who's deeply invested in the community. Find out how she's doing her part to make Brooklyn a better place to live for old-timers and newcomers alike. I'm your host, Christine Stoddard.
And I'm Mari Pack.
This week, it is our absolute pleasure to welcome Antonine Pierre. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course.
Antonine is committed to cultivating powerful communities to create a world that believes we are all inherently valuable. She loves developing meaningful relationships, strategizing, and winning. Since 2011, Antonine has been the lead organizer for the Brooklyn Movement Center, developing the capacity of Central Brooklynites to lead social justice campaigns on issues like street harassment and police accountability. As a founding staff member, she's played an integral role in the development of BMC's organizing strategy and membership base. Her work at BMC is informed by her experiences of having worked in fields of government, youth development, and national policy organizing. So, Antonine, you do a lot of stuff.
That's true.
In our research of you, that is what
we did research?
Yeah, we stalked you.
Oh, man. Oh,
okay, so. I thought that car was a little bit too close to me.
The whole time. You just got two curly-haired girls. Like, what? I don't remember having as many curly-haired people all the time. Oh, yeah. So, because you do so much stuff, we're really interested in, like, how, like, from the very beginning, like, did you grow up in New York City? Because you have this commitment to community organizing at a grassroots level in Brooklyn and New York City at large. Like, what brought you to that? Did it have anything to do with living here as a kid?
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Brooklyn, in Flatbush. So I think of, when I talk, people, for some reason, with community organizing, people are always like, how did you get into organizing? It's like, do people ask doctors, like, how did you get into doctoring? No, it's like, I mean, I don't know.
Poking human bodies.
Yeah, like, we're all sort of on this journey, and there's nothing, I don't think there's anything more magical, necessarily, about an organizer's journey. And it has just as much anxiety as everyone else's journey. But I grew up in Brooklyn, and my family is Haitian immigrant family, and I grew up with a single mom. And if you know anything about Brooklyn and New York and Haitians in the 90s, you know that there's like a lot of social justice shit going on. So there's definitely there's political stuff happening in Haiti with like the Aristide administration, and the Clintons were interfering a lot in Haiti. And then here there was stuff where the Red Cross was saying that they wouldn't accept blood from Haitians, because they were like one of the four H's, like populations that were at high risk for having HIV or AIDS. Mm-hmm. And then there were a couple of high profile police brutality cases under the Giuliani administration in the 90s as well. So there was Patrick Dorisman case. So he was literally an altar boy who Giuliani like unsealed a sealed juvenile record, like a criminal juvenile record. There's Abner Lima, who's brutalized and sodomized by police officers. All of this happened in Flatbush. So I, at a very young age, I understood that some people, or I should say some groups of people, aren't afforded justice. Like, justice isn't something that we all inherently have, and that it is our role as people who face injustice and people who live in worlds without justice, oftentimes, to fight and to demand justice. So I was politicized at a very young age. Thanks a lot, Giuliani administration. and there are probably a lot of people like me who grew up in New York in the 90s who have Giuliani to thank for the fire in our bellies for why we believe justice to be so important and something that we need to all fight for together.
Wow. So since you have been here your whole life, what do you think of the new Brooklyn, the changing Brooklyn?
Listen, Brooklyn ain't going nowhere. Like, there's...
I mean... You trust fund kids, though.
I mean, I think Brooklyn is new to people who have not been here. Of course Brooklyn's changing. I'm not going to say, like, just for the sake of saying it, that Brooklyn isn't changing. But there are definitely parts of Brooklyn that are never going to change, right? There's definitely, like, a Brooklyn fire that some of which is fueled by community organizing. So I might be a little bit biased, but there's like a Brooklyn attitude. There's a Brooklyn way of being that I think is not going to go anywhere. Public housing is not going anywhere. Hmm. So anybody, you know, you think about gentrification being being a like a way that we see class warfare playing out. You know, those trust fund kids, they got something else coming because public housing is not going nowhere. So that to me feels like a very important narrative when we talk about gentrification. When you're up against a force that very much seeks to erase you, not only from Brooklyn's present time, but from like past time, that when you're up against something that seeks to erase you, it's even that much more important to assert, like, I'm here, I've been here, I'm going to keep being here. And if you don't want me to be here, you're going to have to fight me, and I have gloves.
What do you think about, I've been hearing about this a lot, this sort of old theory that justice and equality is something that exists on, like, a very specific linear timeline, and that there's no, like, ups and downs. Like, oh, we start with injustice, and we move forward until we achieve justice. How do you feel about that? Accurate? No?
I mean, who says that?
Where'd you read that?
Who are those people?
Would it surprise you to know it was some white people I was talking to? Yeah, I've been hearing it a lot from, like, conservative Facebook recently in particular.
Why are you on conservative? Where am I?
Do you see?
Calgon, take me away.
Do you see my baby face? That did not come from the Ashkenazi Jew in me. That comes from the Navy brats of Connecticut.
You gotta read everything, both sides.
It's true. All sides, right? Yeah. So I've been reading a lot of that recently. And obviously, to me, my first impulse is like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. But perhaps you have a more nuanced read on that.
I mean, that feels fairly nuanced to me. Anyone who has any concept of social movements or history, and that doesn't mean being a scholar or having a PhD.
Right.
Like, it means seeing that you had enslaved people were emancipated in this country, and then you had Reconstruction, which is a really great period in American history for Black folks in terms of, like, vast advancement very quickly, which is immediately followed by the Jim Crow era and the establishment of the KKK and other hate groups. So if, you know, I'm not even going all the way down the line. I'm talking about, like, we're talking here about what, like a 60-year period where you see things go up and then they go backwards. And that's, you know, that's how progress is almost, it's almost a misnomer here, because is it really progress? It's really just we're consistently moving, and we're trying to keep constant is the direction that we're moving in, but
right,
the shit is zigzagging all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, plus, like, you know, my president Barack Obama said that.
My president. The president.
Yeah, he just do that indefinitely? Like, gives that shit to everyone? Do we just say my president?
I'm not going to talk about the president. I'm going to talk about my president.
I was telling my mother the other day, I'm not going to say President Trump. I'm going to say Trump.
Got him. You said
it. Right. But in everyday conversation, I will not use that phrase. I will say Trump. I will say Donald Trump.
I agree.
Yep.
No, okay, so talking about these waves of being, of just living, you sit as a member on so many different activists and engagement boards, correct? So
I was tricked.
You were tricked?
Yeah, I was like, did you do that on purpose? Like,
yeah, tell us, remind us of all the different boards, all the different activities.
All right, so this feels a little bit like confessions of a, like, workaholic. Maybe not a workaholic. I don't think I'm a workaholic, but maybe it's like confessions of, like, a leadershipaholic or something. Which is, I'm on the board of Families for Freedom, which is an organization that fights at the intersection of immigrant rights and criminal justice. So they work against deportations. I am on the steering committee of Communities United for Police Reform, which is a citywide coalition that has been working for the past 5 years to push through reforms on the policy reforms, and also doing really important community empowerment work around the city. I'm on the advisory committee for the Advocacy Institute, which is an organization that works to resource grassroots groups with tools to do really effective advocacy at the city and state level. And I'm also on the executive committee of the New Yorkers for Social Justice PAC, which is a political action committee founded by a bunch of social justice people who were like, we're doing all of this policy and campaign work, and we need to really find ways to influence elected officials in the way that they are responsive, which is money. Yeah. and how can we as people who do social justice work play a little bit of the political game, but do it in favor of social justice values? So those are all the different things that I'm on. I mean, you asked how, and I made a joke about being a leadershipaholic. And where, I think we've all, a lot of us who are on the left have been having, going through a lot of crises.
Yeah.
post the election of, I don't even know what to call this administration. It's like fascist fuckheads. Like that alliteration.
So that's the beginning of a poem,
right?
We do fight spoken word
on the program.
So it's led me to, one of my crises has really led me to think about, well, what is leadership, and what does it mean to be a leader, and what does it mean for me that I've been in leadership positions in every organization I've been a part of since I was 15, why do people approach me about leadership opportunities? Like, because I didn't go seeking out most of those things that we talked about.
Right.
Like, I was very well recruited. Maybe not tricked. Apologies. But, I was very well recruited into leadership positions. And after the election, I was thinking a lot about the fact that the leadership paradigm that we have in nonprofits and social justice work is very fucked up, because it says, let's go find people who are good at following through, who have great ideas, who are able to bring people together and inspire them, who are able to make spreadsheets. Let's bring together the people who have the skills that we're going to need. Mm-hmm. Or let's find people who have the skills to do what we're going to need, and let's convince them to use those skills in service of whatever mission of the organization is. Mm-hmm. And what's fucked up about that is that it creates this idea that leadership is very finite, mm-hmm. and there's a finite number of people who have those skills, which is true. But what it doesn't operate from a place of leadership development, right? So leadership development model is thinking, okay, we have all of these things, the spreadsheets, whatever, that need to get done, and there's so many people who are excited, and what would it take not to satisfy this leadership need right this very second, but to develop people into leaders, to train them, to help them get those skills to be able to do this. That, when we operate in that way, we see that there's actually more than enough leadership, right? There's mm-hmm. there's the capacity for more than enough leadership. So I was starting to get really frustrated, because I was just like, man, I'm involved in all this stuff because people think that I'm capable. But in reality, capable people should be developing other people to be capable, so that we can generally increase the capacity, because the model that we're in right now clearly just leads to burnout. So we're all going to be mm-hmm. fucked up, because I just named three or four. I don't even know how many things I'm on.
Are you tired?
I mean, everybody's tired.
No. I mean, personally, how do you manage all of that?
Activist burnout is a real thing.
Activist burnout is a real thing. And in thinking about leadership the way that I've been thinking about it, I recognize that there are going to be things that I'm going to have to quit. Yeah. And not because, I'm burned out necessarily, but because maybe I'm not the right person to be involved mm-hmm. in some of those things. And also, saying yes to being involved in other people's organizations means that there's stuff that I'm personally leaving on the table. That there, maybe there are things that I want to be doing that I could be doing in my free time that I don't have because I'm sleeping when I'm not working.
Yeah.
So, and to answer your question about how do I manage, I mean, I think there's this real, I don't know, it's this strange, really self-indulgent culture around self-care.
Yeah.
Or not even culture. It's there's actual self-care, and then there's the smoke and mirrors where people are oh, what's your self-care? And it's
bathe myself, do dishes, go to bed on time,
pay my rent.
It feels like it's become very trendy to talk about self-care.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And, you can't be trendy when you actually trying to, people are doing this work and managing illness, we're struggling. And so what my self-care looks like is really, it starts with a commitment to self-care. I think it's easy to say, like, I'm going to take, you know, instead of a regular shower, I'm going to take a lovely long bath to bathe myself, right? But you can't even get to that point if you aren't already committed to, like, whatever that bath is going to bring you in your self-care. So knowing, you know, going into your day knowing, like, I'm going to need to have some time for myself. What are the things that I could be doing and planning? Like, self-care doesn't just happen, and it is about, like, how can we plan for it, and how does that planning show and increase our commitment to self-care?
Mm-hmm. In the work that you do for the Brooklyn Movement Center, do you have a chance to help develop leadership skills in other people, like in the anti-harassment biking program, for instance?
Yeah, as a lead organizer, I'm working around leadership development throughout our organization. So it is about thinking very intentionally, like, what does leadership look like? How can people be clear about, like, these are the goals that I have, and these, you know, if someone comes into an organization and they're like, they're working on police issues, and they're like, I have a goal of being a spokesperson. I want to be able to talk to press about police issues, because it's something that I've suffered in my own personal life, and, like, having voice around that would be really important to me. That is great. Like, you have worthwhile goals. Like, people don't just become leaders.
Yeah.
I don't even know what that means sometimes. But people don't just like increase skills because they're like around and they're in campaigns. They increase skills because there is an intention to actually do that, and there's a plan to get it done.
So what are some of those intentions? What are the plans? Like, how do you actually help people recognize some of their own gifts and come forward and be leaders?
Yeah, I mean, everything in organizing starts with a one-on-one, you know? So a relationship building is the core of everything you do in community organizing. So for example, like, sometimes people think of community organizing and they think of, like, getting people to go to things. Mm-hmm. And if you think of the last thing that you went to, whether it's like a panel discussion or like you went to a church or something that you don't go to, whatever it was, very likely the last thing that you went to because of a relationship you have with someone. You went to see your friend play at a concert, or, you know, your cousin invited you to her baby shower, whatever it is. Like, you go to things because of your relationships with people. And in community organizing, it's the same thing, right? Like, you may have a commitment to a particular issue, but there are a million things that you could be doing. What is it about this organization at this point in time that means that you're going to be involved? And with organizers, our role really is to build those relationships, to say, like, what is it that you're interested in? What is it that you want out of this organization? This isn't a transactional relationship. This isn't about you just showing up to actions and then us saying that we have lots of numbers. But how can, like, me? I mean, you laugh. That's the real deal.
Yeah.
There's lots of orgs out there that I won't name that do that. So it is about, like, how can I have a one-on-one relationship with someone, and how are we also cultivating a membership where people have strong relationships, so that, of course, the work is important. Of course, like, we're there to do the work. And how are we also building family, and how are we building community in ways that, like, capitalist culture doesn't facilitate?
So you're a founding member of the Brooklyn Movement Center, is that correct?
Staff member.
Founding staff member. So can you tell us a little bit more, what does the Brooklyn Movement Center do?
So the Brooklyn Movement Center, we work in Central Brooklyn, which we define as Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights. And our goal is really to develop the leadership capacity of Central Brooklynites, of low income, low to moderate income, predominantly of color people in Central Brooklyn. And it is important for us to be devoted to developing the leadership, like, Black leadership in a historically Black neighborhood, because we are under siege by gentrification, right? And because we can see ourselves being erased in so many ways, we're creating an organization where people can center themselves and center the things that they want. There's something else you asked. Sorry, Dave. What was the last?
Well, just what do you do on, like, a day-to-day basis? Like, what does your job entail?
My mind is stuck because it was, like, something that you said before that I was, like, trying to answer. Okay, anyway. So that's what we do at the Brooklyn Movement Center.
Mm-hmm.
And what it looks like on a daily basis is just, it's a lot of planning. Like, people, you know, we had an intern this past winter who went with me to a coalition organizing meeting, and then we left. And I was like, how was it? Like, she, you know, she's a college student. She's, I was like, how was it? What do you think about, like, organizing outside of our office? And she's like, yo, I didn't realize it's so much planning. It's just, like, sitting around, like, looking at a calendar, thinking about when things are going to happen and how they're going to happen. And I was like, yep.
Oh, man.
So it's
crushing
it's,
the dreams.
Well, in some ways, it's like any office job, right? Like, it's right. Like, you want to get stuff done. You got to know how you're going to do it and what your resources on are. So it's a lot of planning. It's a lot of, like, writing documents. It's a lot of one-on-one conversations with members and potential members. It's a lot of coalition meetings and meeting with partners and developing the relationships with our allied groups to be able to move the work forward. You know, I think I've often sat in these rooms where there's a community meeting happening and there's a person who says, you know, we need a directory of all the things happening in Central Brooklyn. Hmm. We need to know, or maybe not Central Brooklyn, I should say over the years, I've sat in these meetings all over, in places all over the city. People are like, we need to know what's happening in our neighborhood. And someone should come together with a directory of all the different groups doing all the different work. And like that way we could be more connected as a community. And then inevitably people like start clapping and snapping their fingers and someone's like, yeah, we need somebody to do that. And then everyone thinks that this is an entirely fresh idea, that no one else has come up with it before. And sometimes they might like make a task force or something to come up with this directory, right? And having watched this over and over and over again, I call those like the I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired meetings. Like someone always quotes Fannie Lou Hamer. And the basic issue with that meeting, with the solution, is that community organizing is relationship building. It's not a piece of paper. It's not addresses and phone numbers. It's not knowing where everybody is. It's that I have a relationship with an organizer and I can call them and I can say, hey, can we use your space for a meeting? Or like, do you want to collaborate and like throw a fundraiser slash holiday party together? It is like, do I know the person on the other end? And are they going to put what they're doing on pause because they value collaborating because I'm a real person? And, you know, so when we talk about what organizing is on a daily basis, I think people really, really, they really miss the point that it is about like building those connections, being a real person. Like that's what facilitates a lot of the work happening.
So I'd like to talk about some of the like particular efforts that BMC does. And one of the ones I was really interested in that I feel like is gain more traction in the last couple of years is food justice. So how does food justice play into your efforts?
Yeah, so our major food justice effort, I would say probably our major food justice effort right now is the Central Brooklyn Food Co-op. So for folks who don't know what a food co-op is, a food co-op is it's a cooperative where instead of going to a supermarket where a supermarket is owned by like a conglomerate or like a rich person. Going to a place that's owned by like some like, I don't know, rich person and like hires people to work. A food co-op is owned by the people who shop there. So the consumers own and have a stake in the co-op. And we're doing what's called a member worker model, which means that the customers also work in the supermarket to offset some of the costs. So they like volunteer for shifts. So anyone who's a member of the Park Slope Food Co-op would be familiar with this model. And it allows you to have fairly low-cost food in exchange for, like, labor and membership and also being a part of this community and for a place where you shop to be more than just a place where you shop, right? So to be able to have, like, healthy cooking classes or childcare that can make it easier for people to shop and to, like, buy some of this fancy food. Like, what do I do with a rutabaga? We got a class for that. So, you know, oftentimes when we talk about the food co-op, people are like, that sounds great. Where is it? And I'm like, all right, hold your horses. So food co-ops in the States usually take around 5 years to actually start. And it takes 5 years because it's organizing. If you want to have a food co-op that's run by members, you have to have members. You have to have people who are actually going to shop there. So we're 3.5 years in to our food co-op organizing. We are actually, we've been doing a ton of organizing and surveying people and outreaching to people. And we're formally starting our membership this summer. So we're moving on track, and we see so much of our work, I would say all of our work is anti-gentrification work, because it is around self-determination. It is about, like, what do people actually want to create in their neighborhoods? And our food co-op work is so important because when we think about the ways in which Central Brooklyn has changed and the food market has changed, is that there's now lots of healthy food available, but there's no actual access, right? So you could buy like a $6 bale of beautiful kale, but who has $6 to spend on kale? So this is a way for, like, the people who have always been in Central Brooklyn to have access, to have good low-cost access to foods. Because we do, you know, we will often hear stuff about, like, oh, well, you know, food co-ops are for white people. And it's like, actually, the food co-op is for you. And our, you know, our food co-op board is majority people of color, and there are single moms on our board. And it really is about developing something for the people who live here to participate in like actually getting food on their tables.
What was the cooking class you mentioned?
Oh, I just made that up.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, we've done educational stuff in the past. I mean, it wasn't completely off base. It was an example. And I'm saying that, like, you know, I don't know what the food co-op board is actually working on. Or what they will be working on when the co-op actually opens. We've seen a lot of interest in cooking classes. And, you know, especially as you start to bring in produce, that when you introduce people to produce that they've never actually cooked with before, it is important to have a way for people to know how to cook a root. What is a rutabaga? It's like a root vegetable?
Yeah. I didn't know what kale was until it became popular.
Yeah.
Like, I remember being 20 and being like, ew, what do I have to do with this? And everyone's like, it'll make your poop so good. And then it did. And I've been eating it for 6 years.
Nice.
But have you seen food change in Brooklyn? Like, how has it changed? Has it been with gentrification?
Yeah. Listen, it's all gentrification. Let's start there. So, this is maybe, how old am I now? Maybe a decade ago, I was working in Prospect Park, and I was running this youth program, and we were walking from Prospect Park, we were walking to Crown Heights, and this group of maybe 3 or 4 of us, and we got to Franklin and Eastern Parkway, and a few of us were hungry, so we were like, cool, we're going to go get some food. So we started walking north, so on Eastern Parkway. We were walking on Franklin towards Atlantic Avenue, and we were just looking for some food to eat. And we walked and we walked and we walked and we walked like maybe like 6 or 7 blocks, and then we found this little Bajan spot where we like had a little bit of jerk chicken or whatever, and then we turned around and we went back to Eastern Parkway. And I tell that story because it was so fucking wild that we had to walk so far looking for food.
In a city.
Well, not just in a city, but like in a city where 10 years later, like, these restaurants are closing because they have there's so many of them and so few of us to actually be able to buy it, you know? And like Franklin to me is it's just so ridiculous the way Franklin has turned over. Because I even remember when, I love telling the story, which is when Franklin Park first opened, that summer, I remember just being like, oh, shit, a place, like, I can hang out in Brooklyn, I can take a cab home, I don't have to go to Manhattan late at night, like, I don't have to, like, the idea that I would not have to go to Manhattan for entertainment and to hang out with people was mind-blowing. And I remember that whole summer, it was, like, so chill, so many good vibes, like, people just, so much love, just, like, drinking and hanging out and dancing. And that, you know, I remember, like, I would watch Sex and the City, and Carrie would always talk about places getting destroyed with a rave, and I would be like, these Upper East Side white people, I don't know what the fuck they're talking about. And then that September, look it up, the New York Times fucking wrote this rave review of Franklin Park, and that was it. It was over from then on.
Well, yeah, like, once the New York Times writes their trend piece.
People were busing in from fucking Williamsburg, and, like, I don't even know where Carajole and these hipster-ass people were coming from. They ruined Franklin Park. It was no longer, like, a thing for black people, like, in Brooklyn. It just became this, like, let me not throw too much shade at Franklin Park, because I do like that they have drinks under $10. And, you know, they got that photo booth in the back that's very nice. But when the way that it was just a place for black people to just hang out, mm-hmm. And, like, it wasn't a place where we were thinking about gentrification, it's hard to, you can't be in Franklin Park nowadays and not think about the ways that Brooklyn is changing. So, yeah.
I mean, that must be painful.
It's devastating.
You're from here. That's so...
That's true, yeah.
I think... So, my dad is from Manhattan mm-hmm. originally, and I'm from Arlington, Virginia, which is outside of D.C. Mm-hmm. And Arlington, D.C., and Bethesda, Maryland, that whole area.
The DMV.
Yeah, the DMV. Thank you. Thank you. Shout out.
I was like, you can say it.
I guess I can't. So many people don't... Like, 10 years ago, even 15 years ago, there was so little of interest for young people, mm-hmm. just in general. And then, thank goodness, with the Obama administration coming in, there was so many more restaurants, so many bars, so many more fun things.
Arlington became a thing.
Yeah, Arlington became a mm-hmm. thing, but at the same time, so many family-owned businesses disappeared. And I don't have a lot of nostalgia for the area, but my husband, who's from the same place, is devastated. Mm-hmm. And that's all he can talk about. Like, oh, all these yuppies who came from San Francisco, you know, Ivy League educated kids who came to Arlington and D.C. and Bethesda, the DMV, and they changed it.
I wish I was still yuppies, though, because like, yuppies it's like a 90s thing, right? Like, yuppies.
No, not in D.C. In D.C., all right. It's yuppies. Sorry, yeah. In New York, it's hipsters. That's why.
But I remember in the 90s, like, you know, when the economy was doing well, that like I do remember like yuppies becoming a thing because there were all these super young people making mad money in corporate America and like in Manhattan and paying, you know, and that was something that I watched from Brooklyn, like, all right, that's cool.
Still in DC though, like, so I know 25-year-olds from making six figures, no joke, right, because they're working for government consultants,
right? And it's you know, I kind of like, I almost long for those days because yuppies at least stayed in Manhattan. Like, now, like, they're here and they're yuppies, they're hipsters. It's like everybody's trying to get a little piece. Yeah, it's just wild. Yeah, I mean, it the thing of the Franklin Park story brings up for me just this question that you always have in undervalued black neighborhoods, which is, how can we get the nice things? How can we get like the things that we want to enjoy, to like that we want to add to our quality of life, without getting displaced, without this making it an attractive place for people who have more money than us to live. So that's the shit with Franklin Park, because it was just like, all I wanted was a little bar where I didn't have to cross the river and I could hang out on Saturday night. And then it's gone now, you know. Like, yeah. And there are lots of other places, and you know, I rarely go to Manhattan these days outside of work anyway. But there still aren't really good answers to that question of like, how do you how do you actually economically develop a neighborhood and allow for variety in the kinds of businesses that exist without like pricing out the people who live there?
Well, like in D.C., the problem there is it used to be a majority black city, and it's mm-hmm. not anymore since mm-hmm. the Obama administration, funny mm-hmm. enough. Because
I saw that article in the Times.
Yeah,
too. No, it was the Post. It was the Washington Post.
Yeah, the Post had their trend pieces.
Oh, but I just saw some horrible things.
So many people of color in general had to move out. Like Columbia Heights used to be predominantly Latino, and now it's very white. Mm-hmm.
And I have a friend who now who is white and works in Columbia Heights for those communities.
What does that mean, for those communities?
Well, I wanted to ask you.
No. Is she a domestic worker? Like, what should be for those communities?
No. He's a man, and he does food justice.
Okay.
And for this, Columbia Heights communities. Like, that is, it means that his organization targets the community. I'm using air quotes for our listeners.
Yeah, yeah.
The communities of Columbia Heights. Because it's clearly a bunch of, like, well-meaning, like, middle-class people are like, we want to help the community.
Okay, middle-class, white, college-educated people
who
are not
who, like, want to
necessarily from the area, coming into the area.
They see a need. They don't really do their research. They're like, we want to help the community. And so
I so love all of your both air quotes and also, like, interpretive dancing for the whole community.
Well, wish the listeners can see.
You're full on welcome to call me out if I'm doing some bullshit
stuff. I love it because it's been, like, a real bane of my existence that like, this conversation about the community. I remember in college I did this project on, I had to, like, look at the website of an organization and dissect it, and I looked at the website of I think it's like the Rush Foundation. And I saw that Russell Simmons kept talking about, like, the community and the youth. And, like, my whole paper was like, who is, which youth? where they at? Like, do they live in a place? Are they spread out? Is it a chat group? Like, I don't understand. So it's, you know, the community, the youth, these are all these, like, trash ass code words.
They're euphemisms mean, like, that white poor people use.
Yeah, and what you mean is poor black people, or poor people who speak Spanish, or, like, poor, you know, like, what you're saying is poor people. And it's not just white people who use it, right? Like, everybody does that, the community shit.
Once they,
like,
get to a certain income level.
Well, not even income level. I mean, poor black people do it too. Like, we all use it as a euphemism for, like, other poor black people. It's this weird idea that you can only have community if you're poor. Right? Like, if you have money, like, you don't need to do nothing.
You're part of the larger community, which is called society.
Right. Like, you definitely some kind of society if you have money. But yeah, so it creates this way of thinking about community as something that you only need if you don't have money. And it's like, that's bullshit. We all need community. We all have community. We have families and friends.
Yeah.
Like, that's all real. Why don't we talk about the actual communities and the fact that we as individuals are part of many communities over the course of our lives? We all went to different schools, like different elementary school, high school, whatever. We're all, like, not all, but, like, some people are part of houses of worship and some people are part of political clubs. Like, your workplace is a community. We don't talk about the ways in which communities are just, like, collections of people who have a certain dynamic.
I think one of the reasons why we might call community is because there is this notion that, like, oh, well, poor black folks don't have money, but they've got the community. They have this other equally valuable thing. Like, what
well,
do you think?
You know, federal government keeps shitting on it. We ain't gonna have community.
Anything.
Like, well, you wanna keep fucking deporting people, we ain't gonna have nobody. That was also to my President Obama as well. Also supporting people.
Well, what I wanted to connect something that Mari said to something that you said earlier, Antonine. Mari, you were talking about your non-Hispanic friend in Columbia Heights, your white friend organizing in what traditionally was a Hispanic and Latino neighborhood. And I wanted to ask you how you feel about people who have they're able to check things off this certain list, this certain idea of what quote unquote leadership is. What do you think it's okay for people outside of a certain quote unquote community to come into a community that's not their own and organize?
That's a really good question.
Like, should organizations only be drawing from homegrown talent and cultivating leadership there? Or sometimes is it necessary to bring somebody from elsewhere?
Christine and I have this argument all the time, and we want, like, we're looking for answers because we don't know.
Oh, all tell right. us the hard well, truth.
Yeah, well, no, we want to know.
Be well, honest. Here's the thing. Questions are some of the most beautiful things in life. Like, you know, like, you don't get much from absolute truth, right? It's either it is or it isn't. Yeah. But with questions, you can be curious and explore. I'm going a little off, but I am saying that, like, sometimes we don't always have answers, and it is about being in constant state of question. I'll start by saying that the executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center, Mark Winston Griffith, wrote this really great and still relevant article back in 2003 in the Gotham Gazette called Black Organizer Blues that addresses this a little bit. And, like, I give it to, like, every staff person that starts at BMC, just, like, read it.
It's great context. Is it online? Where can we find it?
It should be on the internet, and and what I can also do is post it somewhere and send y'all a link.
That'd be great. We can put it on our Facebook page.
Yeah, because I definitely have a PDF of it. And, you know, it's a complicated answer, right? Because it goes back to this idea of leadership development. It's like, okay, well, we need to be doing shit now. And do we have time to develop? And, like, who are the people who are going to be doing this development? There are, you know, different schools of thought around community organizing. And it's really, really important to be, at least the organizing that we do, to constantly be centering the experiences of people who have been exploited by the issues. Because they're, you know, this, it's really easy for people to think that, well, experts need to do things, and experts need to be, like, you're a professional community organizer, like, tell me what you think, or, like, solve the issue for me. And one, that perpetuates people, like, not being able to develop those skills. We've already been talking about that, right? But then it's also that the part of the problem is that people, like, don't have voice around these issues. They don't have power. So how are you going to do organizing where you're like, oh, like, we're going to be powerful, but, like, I'm the one who's going to talk to press.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I'm going to speak for you. Or I'm going to, or you're going to show up to a meeting with a city council member, and you're just going to tell your sob story, but I'm going to talk to them about policy because I know policy. Mm-hmm. Right? So it is about, like, how are we all organizers? I often will say, you know, I want to continue seeing myself as more of, in a support role, right? Like, how can I facilitate, like, people working on campaigns and developing their own leadership? But this isn't, in some ways, being a paid organizer and being in any sort of leadership role, to me, is about how are you doing that facilitation as opposed to doing the work yourself. So in terms of folks coming from outside, like, just on GP, like, come on, dog. Like, there's, like, it's just, is it your issue, you know? And I think the lines start to get a little bit blurred when we, because of gentrification, because this is the first time in, like, history that we can remember where this is the first time in history that we can remember where there's been a stigma around, like, middle-class Black people moving into a low-income or working-class neighborhood, or people who come from a middle-class background and, like, have formal education and have earning potential, meaning that Black people have been moving to places where other Black people live for decades, and that's because people, you know, it's, you couldn't, as a Black person, you couldn't live in another neighborhood. Yeah. You could only live where Black people live.
Red, so, like, line.
To have a Black neighborhood that's mixed income, it wasn't like, oh, were you too good for us or whatever. Like, it wasn't like, oh, you're an outsider. It's like, well, we all Black and we all have faced a certain level of oppression. So the lines of, like, who can come in and do organizing, like, I think first and foremost, you do, like, it does need to be led and worked on by people from a particular neighborhood. And then from there, you just got to figure shit out, you know? Mm-hmm. Just figure out, like, where it is. Because a lot of, because there are obviously really dope organizers who are not Black, who are doing really amazing work in Black neighborhoods, or who are leading organizations doing really amazing work. And there's always a question for me of, like, but what's the philosophy, and, like, where's the organizing strategy coming from? Is it really led by these people, or are they just tokens? Mm-hmm. And that's real, and those are the people who are like, we need numbers at the rally and we're not developing you. But how there is a question of, like, if you do have work that's not led by people of color or Black people or whatever, how is it being done?
Yeah. often one place where you see one aspect of community organizing, where you see people from outside of the community coming in, is with language services for translation mm-hmm. and interpretation. And I was wondering, with your family being Haitian, is that correct? Mm-hmm. If language services were ever something that your family needed growing up, and if that's something that comes into play with what you do at the Brooklyn Movement Center now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, at BMC right now, we don't really do language services. We don't currently have any members who don't speak English or don't primarily speak English. That could change as we like increase our outreach, and we're definitely open to being able to have those services available. And we'll make those services available. And, you know, in my family, you know, everybody in my family spoke English.
Right.
So there wasn't a need for a translation quite so much. And, like, I don't know, there's a lot of white people out there speaking Creole. I don't know what that's about.
So not textbook French, but Creole? Like,
well, so here's the thing. So Creole is the, like, language that everyone in Haiti speaks,
yeah.
And French is taught in school, so it's a language that speaking it signifies a level of aristocracy, mm-hmm. and it means that, like, you have money to go to school, and it's like, you know, Haitians have all their class shit, and so not all Haitians speak French is the point, but right. all Haitians do speak Creole, so you know. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. So there's not really a need for Creole or Spanish or other languages at the Brooklyn Movement Center
Now. Currently there isn't, and I do want to stress that, like, you know, I think we can and will make those services available. I think it's oftentimes, like, you'll have an org and it's like, oh, well, you have to make it so that people feel like there's a place for them there. So it's like, mm-hmm. if we never make language services available, then obviously we're never going to get anyone walking through the door, because they're going to be like, oh.
This isn't the place for me.
Yeah. Or it's like, you know, for every meeting we advertise that we have, that we can do childcare by request. We don't get a lot of requests for childcare, but we want you to know when you look at it, like, all right, there's a place for people who need childcare here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering if we could deflect for a little bit, and can we talk about the anti-street harassment?
Yeah!
Because that, so when I went to the website and looked it up, you have, like, this whole paragraph, and I'd like to read a little bit of it now,
mm-hmm.
As sort of, like, a condition for discussing street harassment.
Yep.
It's that we have found words to be limited as we attempt to communicate analysis of race, gender, sexuality, and class as they pertain to street harassment. Without clear language standards in the anti-street harassment movement and within the larger feminist, trans, gender nonconforming, and queer rights movements, we have made the decision to use words and phrases that we find to be inclusive and specific, though not perfect. We are constantly working to clearly convey our interpretation of an unjust set of circumstances and welcome conversation around finding the most appropriate language moving forward. So why is it so hard to talk about street harassment?
I mean, I don't know that it's not, like, inherently hard to talk about street harassment. I think that these systems of oppression, though,
they're all jumping on top of each other.
Well, they're not perfect, right?
Yeah.
So systems of oppression are entirely manufactured, but then, like, they're manufactured in a way where they're anchored in. Oftentimes anchored in physical characteristics, it gives you the impression that they're real. So then you're separating out, like, the fakeness and the bullshit of the oppressive system from the things that you actually know and understand to be real, right? So you're separating gender from, like, secondary sex characteristics, like facial hair. You're trying to really right. parse them apart because, like, facial hair is a real thing, but gender isn't. So, and gender, like, the gender as an oppressive system has implications in all of our lives, some good, some not good. So there's also, like, all of these different levels of, like, the system sucks. It's all, they're linked into things that are real and tangible. And also, like, what? Like, the reverberations of, like, what all of those things mean. All, like, so there are, like, lots of other things to untangle that are connected to gender. So that's, it's like, you know, a lot, that so much of that paragraph is like, look, we didn't create this shit. It's all fucked up. We're really trying hard to find good language to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's still fucked up.
Oh,
our
gosh,
language
yeah.
will continue to be imperfect as the systems are fucked up. And, you know, just like be patient with us and understand that we are constantly growing, and language is also not static, and language is constantly changing. And the language that we use in our foundation documents, with no disrespect, our subject, you know, 10 years from now, some shit might not be status quo, and then we'll have to change it in the work.
So how does the force work on a day? How does the group work on a weekly basis or whatever it may be?
I don't know about weekly.
Monthly, yearly.
Yeah, so no disrespect. When we talk about street harassment, we're talking about unwanted advances of a gendered or sexualized nature. And those are occurring to generally to women, queer folks, trans folks, gender nonconforming folks. And people are usually familiar with this in the form of someone yelling like, hey, baby, at you, or
hey,
saying that you have nice legs, or following you home, or harassing you when, like, as a woman, you're with your girlfriend, or, you know. So there are lots of different ways in which street harassment happens. And we find it important to, like, name the problem, to work to denormalize it, and to work to, like, restabilize our community. So denormalizing it means an investment in storytelling. So we've had several events where we've centered storytelling, and we like had a Tumblr where we centered storytelling. And the idea really is that people who are frequently harassed often don't talk about the harassment, and not talking about it perpetuates that it's okay, and that it only happens to you, and this is your own personal problem. So the more you talk about street harassment, the more you, or I should say, the less you exceptionalize your experience, and you also realize that other people are having this experience. And then we can collectively do the organizing work, or at the very least, like, you can have some of your trauma alleviated by talking to someone about the harassment that's happening to you. So storytelling is really important for us. Another piece is that we want to really make sure that folks are able to resist when it comes to street harassment. So we often walk away from instances of being harassed feeling really scared, just kind of feeling crappy, like someone just ruined our day, feeling angry. So we're often left with all this shit. And one thing that we had been exploring with No Disrespect was, well, how do we make it so that people can either take control of the situation, or like a bystander can also like help out? Like, what does that look like? So we have these really dope cards. I'm biased, they're very dope. That say like, what you can, you know, here's some things, here's some ways you can de-escalate a harassment situation if you're being harassed. Here's some ways that you can de-escalate if someone else is being harassed. So, and this is for like people who are frequently harassing each other and like helping out, right? So for example, like Mari, if I see you and you're being, you know, I see like some dude is like talking to you, won't let you go. You clearly, like, you're turning away. You clearly don't want to be talking to this person.
Using all of my body language to communicate.
Right.
I don't like this.
That's right. I could walk over and I could ask the person who's harassing you for the time. Or I could pretend to know you. You know, like, I could walk up to you and be like, hey, Jane, it's so good to see you. And my room would be like, what's up, Rebecca? And then, you know, like, so this is a way of taking the attention away from the harasser, away from the harassment, not confronting the harasser, and making it a safe environment. Because, again, the power of harassment comes in it not being seen, of it being normalized.
Mm-hmm.
So at the point that another person is there, this guy's like, first of all, you trying to fuck with my vibe?
I saw her first.
Well, because it's like, it's all about power. Like, all like sexual harassment and violence is about power.
Definitely.
But, you know, this guy's got all the patriarchy in his mind, and he's like, I'm trying to step to her. So, like, that's happening, right? So that's the thing that we do, and we, like, have these cars, and we... the primary way that we give these cards out is we go out on bike patrols. So we have a group that of people who are harassed, because, again, this needs to center the people who are affected by it. Like, how are we getting back something. So we do bike patrols, we do walk patrols, where we go out, we give this information to people who are frequently harassed. They're like, thanks so much, this is so interesting. You know, like, we usually get really good responses. And then probably thinking like, oh, but what about like getting guys to stop harassing people, right?
Yeah.
And you know, when I say guys, I mean primarily cisgendered straight men are the ones who benefit from patriarchy, are the ones who are generally doing the harassment, are the ones who are generally not harassed themselves.
Right.
So we have a group of like men and masculine of center men who are working to like, one, like work on their own shit, figure out their own relationship to patriarchy, and two, develop like ways for talking to men about street harassment that that like can do that work, that culture change work of changing hearts and minds. So we're and like how they can have those conversations in public spaces where you often see men, and there are like, it's just men. So it would be like a barber shop or like a church group, like a men's church group. So we're, you know, the work of ending street harassment outside of criminalization is about culture change, because we also recognize in a gentrifying neighborhood, in a historically Black neighborhood, it's not always safe for a person being harassed, like a Black person being, a Black woman being harassed, like as I am often harassed. It's not always going to be safe for me to call the cops, because the cops may blame me. They might be like, why are you wearing that skirt? Or why are you here at this time of night? Which are things that we've heard police saying, right? So, and we also know that like the neighborhood is already heavily criminalized. So what I don't need to do is subject this man who's already being criminalized to more criminalization. You know, he might lose his job, and people might be like, well, maybe he should think twice about harassing. Look, God is working on all of us, okay?
Like, nobody's perfect.
You know, we do have a responsibility as people who don't believe in criminalization to find alternatives to solve the issues that we have, and these are a few of the strategies that we're using.
Do you ever have a chance to talk to parents of little boys about, or teachers, just about the way that we raise little boys and even little girls?
Yeah, that's a tall order.
Yeah, that's, no, like, it's a lot. No parent wants to hear that.
So it's like, you talk to all the parents and all the teachers of all the little boys.
Round them all up.
Everybody.
Like, yeah. One gymnasium.
All of the community.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we focus our work on adults. And that's a choice that we made because we're a small collective. And, you know,
totally.
We ain't got the resources. Like, youth development resources cost moolah. So if you got some of that, you would like us to do youth work, then let's talk.
We'll it's already amazing work. I mean,
I'm just saying, we'll use all that sweet badass lady money that we've been hiring over our season and funnel it in.
And we don't want to do work that other people are doing, right? So one of our favorite orgs, Girls for Gender Equity, based in Brooklyn. They do a lot of really amazing work with young women. They do work in schools. And we don't find that it's necessary for us to be doing the work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. It's necessary for us to be able to work together. But it's not higher on our list at this point.
Thank you so much, Antonine, for talking about all the work you do at the Brooklyn Movement Center, some of the other boards that you're on. We really appreciate it.
No, thank y'all for having me. It's
absolutely
dope.
I feel like I have learned something and I have laughed something. You have been listening to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Tune in next week for more interviews with the women changing Brooklyn.
And while you're at it, also consider donating. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/badassladyfolkbk, and there we have information about how to make a donation. Thanks so much.